Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We are back on a musical topic today, jazz, and I hope we'll get to hear a little music during the show from our guests. Today's topic is the Alaska Jazz Workshop, alive and well here in Anchorage since 1995. It is the brainchild of musician, composer, and educator John Damberg, who says the workshop has mentored or inspired more than 3,000 students right here in Anchorage. John says his students range in age from 7th grade to age 70. We'll meet John and learn a lot about how he approaches teaching music and the many lessons to be gleaned from spending time playing music with others. We'll hear from some of John's students about how this activity has influenced their lives and their understanding of jazz and how to play it. Today's show is pre-recorded to accommodate schedules, so we won't be taking your calls during the show. But if you have questions or comments, we'll eventually get back to you, and you can always send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. When I asked John how people can learn more about jazz, he suggested three websites, and those are listed on our website today at alaskapublic.org under the Hometown Alaska tab. So if this show gets you wanting to know more, check out NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, the National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Masters website, and the Jazz Education Network website. Don't worry about remembering that. Just go to alaskapublic.org under Hometown. We've got those links there and a link to the Alaska Jazz Workshop as well. So let's get started. I'm going to we have four people in the studio today. We have lots of musical instruments, which you're going to get to hear. And we have three students and John Damberg. So I'm going to start with John. John, your bio is incredible, but first let's just start with talking about the Alaska Jazz Workshop, because that's really why we're here. I have done shows on the Spinard Jazz Fest and Akimi, which is a local independent musicians, but I had never done anything on the Jazz Workshop, and I thought, what an asset in our community, and it's been here for a long time. John, tell us how you got it started back in 1995.
Yeah, well, first of all, good morning.
Yes.
And I got started because I'm a music teacher. I'm a percussionist, and I play some piano, too. In fact, piano was my first instrument, and I took up drums in fifth grade like most kids do.
So you can really relate to your students.
Yeah. But what I up here in Alaska, I moved up from Seattle in 1991, and I found that it took three things to make a living. For a lot of Alaskans, you know, I looked around and I started out, I first came up here in tourism when I was going to school at the University of Washington, getting my master's in music and jazz studies and ethnomusicology. So I drove tour buses and ran the trains on the McKinley Explorer and became a tour director for Holland America for a number of years in the summers. And then while I was doing that, I was checking out the music scene to see what was available. And what got me to come up here originally was a job offer, like with many people. The University of Alaska Anchorage had an opening for their percussion position. So I applied for that and got that in 1991 and then moved up. So that is just a part-time position. Over there, I run the percussion ensemble and teach percussion methods classes for education, music education majors, mm-hmm. and teach private lessons. But that's not a full-time job, so I looked around and saw that nobody was teaching percussion and drums on a full-time basis. So I thought maybe I should hang my shingle out and do that.
As a private
instructor. Yeah, as a private teacher, instructor. Right. Uh-huh. And within a year or year and a half, I had pretty much a full studio. I teach 20 to 25 hours a week of private students. And then, so that's one thing I was doing. The second, and then the UAA was the second thing. And then the third thing, I'd sub in the school district. And because I have an extensive background in as a drummer, percussionist, in all styles of music, especially improvisation, drummers are always expected to improvise because most of the music we read is just a cliff note sketch of what's supposed to be there. It's not a literal translation of what's there. Mm-hmm. So like if you're a clarinet player or a flute player, you read the music on the page. And the only thing that your band director talks to you about is how loud, how soft, so dynamics, articulations, whether to play the notes short or soft or slur the notes. So you're sort of becoming a musical technician. They expect you to know the notes on your instruments. And how to play loud, soft, short, long articulations, and how to follow the conductor, right?
Because that's the boss in that situation, I guess, the conductor?
Correct, correct. So a lot of those students don't develop a very good internal rhythmic clock, right? So the drum section in the concert band and in the symphony orchestra was the last section to be added. And they're in the back of the group mm-hmm. because I think that's the only space they had to put them. A lot of people tell you that that's because drummers play loud and they don't want them to overshadow the violin players or the flute players. I don't think that's right. I just think that's because they were the last guys to come in.
It's the spot they had for
them. That's the only place they had. But a lot of drummers, they're drummers because they learn orally. Drums have always been taught, whether in Aboriginal cultures of Africa or Asia or the Americas, orally. It was never written down. And part of that is that drumming always went with a story. Like in Africa, Western Africa, drumming was related via the griots. The griots are the musical historians. They're the lawyers, and they play drums. They usually use like a talking drum, a squeeze drum you hold under your arm.
Because there's lessons in these stories, and yeah. But the drum is part of that presentation.
Correct. For them, everything is rhythm. Whether you're pounding millet, you're getting water, you're walking your cattle, you're having a social gathering. You know, they use drums for communication. They use drums for entertainment. They use drums for going from this world into the spirit world. Same thing with the natives up here. They use the drum as the super highway to get between here and the spirit world, right? The shaman mm-hmm. use that. So anyways, drummers...
They don't get the credit they deserve?
they just learn differently.
They learn differently, yeah.
Right? From all my years of teaching, I've realized that there's two major categories of learners. There's linear learners who like to learn long strings of information and memorize it, or not. But like you take a piano student. The big thing with a classical piano student from the beginning in the old days was learn your scales, learn your chords. Here's this little sonatina, let's memorize it, we're gonna have a little recital. Now some kids like playing solo, and other ones are just fearful as all get out. Mm-hmm. That turns them right off, you know? And some people just wanna play with a group, right? But for most of those instruments, they're either talking playing in a group as being in a big like concert band or orchestra, or you're playing solo. And when you get to be a more advanced player, then you play maybe in smaller chamber ensembles, like a string quartet or a mixed trio, like piano, clarinet, and cello or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. But for the majority of kids, they learn that way. Well, drummers aren't that way, and bass players aren't that way, and guitar players aren't that way. They're what I call circular learners. They take a 1 to 2 measure pattern that revolves like the wheel of a car. It keeps, you know, turning around back on itself, which is very African and very Asian. And this keeps the car moving ahead so that the linear learners who play their parts on top can develop that part of it, too. But if they don't have the wheels for their car,
gotcha.
They're dead in the water. So the reason drummers are like they are is because this is how they process information. So if you take a swing song... And there's like thousands of swing songs. Basically what they do, because they aren't focused on reading music on the page, they're a combination between the bus driver for the band. They always know where they're going. They know the form of the tune. They are the social host. They invite everybody into the tune. They play little cues that are set up by fills to lead you from the verse to the chorus to say the guitar solo or the sax solo or the piano solo back into the tune mm-hmm. again. So they're the ones that, you know, open the tune, direct the tune through. So without a conductor, they are the conductor.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how to take over that role.
Yeah. And then they invite you to the end of the tune. So if you don't have a drummer who can set up the ending of the song, even if, say, the piano player plays the dee-da-da-ba-ba-ba-doo-bop, unless the drummer sets that up, the rest of the band will fall apart.
Okay.
The drummer always has to be thinking ahead. The other thing is the drummer is the mother hen, and he or she is always collecting their chicks because they and the bass player are usually the only people that play all the way through a tune. everybody else comes and goes and comes and goes. And when they stop, they get distracted by one thing or another. You know, like, what are we having for lunch? What am I doing after school? Whatever.
And is it my turn next?
Right. And then the drummer says, oh, we just did that tune one time through. For your solo, it's your turn. He goes, da-da-da-da-da-ba-doo-da-da-boom. And so that next player knows it's their turn to start. Right. So anyways, back to how this got started.
How Alaska Jazz Workshop got started. Okay.
So when I go out into the school district, I do a lot of subbing. And because I have a mastery skill from being on the bandstand for years and years, in everything from jazz bands to rock bands to symphony orchestras to show bands to backing up Vegas entertainers to doing Broadway shows. Everything. I played pretty much every style of music you can play. And drummers coming up in the 20th century played a lot of weird music, especially if you're a percussionist, because the composers in the 20th century really sort of exploited the whole percussion section. Mm-hmm. But the thing that they didn't do, most of them, is they didn't realize that drummers are motorifically active, most of them, 8
out of
10. What
does motorifically mean?
It means they have to play all the time.
Okay.
Right? And they have great four-way coordination. They can't start and stop. And this is the problem with a concert band or an orchestra, especially an orchestra, is the drummer will play a triangle and then rest for 80 measures. Well, they can't focus that long because a lot of drummers are ADHD. They have ADD. A lot of them have dyslexia, right? Uh-huh. So they don't trust their eyes, which is why they learn orally. I have a number of students who are autistic, highly functioning autistic, and are on the Asperger's scale, right? For them, it's therapy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So rather than doing the spinner thing, I think there's this thing the last couple of years that kids get, you know, you can spin.
Right.
They play drums. It's the same thing. Right. So they tend to be very brilliant people, but they just, they process information in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of times, and
Let me just break in and say, what you have demonstrated here is this amazing capacity as an educator. I mean, you've got your experience, not only your professional experience, but your teaching experience and exposure to kids of all types, trying to share music with them. It just comes through in your conversation. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, back to the school. So I'd go sub in these schools for a number of times in the middle schools and the high schools, mm-hmm. and I basically have subbed in every school in this district and out in the Mat-Su. And what I would do after a while is the teachers I would sub for would either have me sub for them on Fridays when the kids are checking out for the weekend or on Mondays when they're checking back in, right? So I would just, when I first was getting to know the students, I just run the regular repertoire, you know, that the teacher wanted me to run. If they were preparing for a concert, I'd run through the pieces. And then if I sub for them again and it was a ways, the concert was a ways away, then I would say, hey, let's do something interesting. And the kids would go, okay.
What
music are we going to play, right? And I said, just get your instruments out. You'll see. So then I started doing music show and tell. Because what I realized working on the concert band pieces is I'd stop and I'd have six sax players who were supposedly playing in unison, meaning they're supposed to play the same part, playing six different parts because nobody had ever taught them how to count rhythmically.
Ah.
Or they were totally out of tune with each other because nobody tuned them up,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, there's the old chicken and the egg story. Which comes first, rhythm or melody? And, of course, as a percussionist, it's rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
If a band can't count together and they can't groove together with a rhythm, you can put those melody notes all over the place and it just sounds like a bunch of popcorn popping here and there. There's no continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, I started doing these creative little exercises like music show and tell. Because the other thing I realized is that the kids would sit next to somebody for a whole year and they didn't even know the name of their next door neighbor. So I thought, well, hey, let's have them share a tune because that's the last thing a band teacher ever asks you. Could you play something for us? Do you have something to share for us? Because they have this agenda, you know,
and
these
they get
songs.
The, have to prepare the group for some concert or something.
Right, yeah. But what they're forgetting is, I think a lot of band teachers, is they're forgetting to share their passion of why they like music and why they like to teach music, and they're just trying to stay with the schedule,
mm-hmm.
right? And then they also forget that music, just like any the other art, it should be a creative art form. not just an interpretive art form. It should mm-hmm. be creative.
Yeah. So that's what you do with these kids. You give them a chance to play off each other and listen to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, I have a kid show them. It might be Happy Birthday or Three Blind Mice or whatever. And then I say to the rest of the class, okay, it's in the key of F. It starts on one of the key of F. Figure it out. Mm-hmm. So you have cacophony for about 5 minutes, and then about half the band can play it. I says, anybody can play it, play it. So those half play it, and the other half are like looking at the other half going, I'm afraid. I don't know how to do this stuff. So then I say to the ones that get it, I say, turn to your right or turn to your left and introduce yourself to your neighbor. All right? And say something about yourself. And I says, the people that can play the song now, show the people that can't play it mm-hmm. how to do it. And I don't care how you do it. Watch their fingers. Listen. Communicate. This is an A. That's a B. That's a C. Mm-hmm. However you want to communicate and teach the other student. And that makes the person who knows the tune feel good.
Yeah.
And also it creates this energy, pure interaction.
Uh-huh.
Then pretty soon, after about another 5 minutes, everybody's got it.
So it's just a really, you must be refreshing when you come into the classroom for students, because it seems like this is really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so the other thing I did is usually as a band teacher, one of your periods is jazz band. And most band teachers in the past don't know how to teach improvisation, because they all have to take 2 years of music theory in college, but they think it's like pulling teeth at the dentist because they're never shown how to use it. It's not practical music theory. To me, music theory is like having a screwdriver and a wrench, and you got some pipes to fix. You learn how to use that screwdriver.
Tweaking and adjusting.
Yeah. So you don't just study music of dead people, composers, right? You actually say, okay, well, here's an idea. Here's this chord that we're going to build, like a major chord or a minor chord. Or if this is a melody, how do these chords support this melody?
Mm-hmm.
So part of me is a scientist, too. I want to take the whole song apart and see what it is, mm-hmm. that why it functions. That's the only way I can remember. So I'm sort of half piano player, half drummer. I'm half linear and I'm half a circular learner.
Let me go back to the jazz workshop, just because we got a good picture of you as an educator in the Anchorage School District and what you brought there that wasn't quite there. But then there's this whole jazz workshop, which is year-round, which is not the school district, right, which is adults. So talk a little bit about that. And then after that, we'll introduce our other guests, because they've been quietly listening and shaking their heads yes to things that John said. But we'll get them on the air, too. But just tell me a little, like, just give us the outline of the jazz workshop. I know it started in 95, but I mean, you've got classes for adults, you've got classes for middle school and high school, you give concerts, these kids, so just give us a little bit of that.
Sure. Well, what the Alaska Jazz Workshop grew out of is in 95, I realized from teaching these jazz classes that the kids didn't know how to improvise, or they didn't know anything about music theory, so they were playing all the wrong notes. But really, there's no wrong notes. They just hadn't tuned into like listening to how it sounded against the chord they were playing against. So nobody had ever taught them that. So I started showing them how to play the blues the spring of 95. And then later on, they went home and they had a good time. So they started telling their parents about me. And their parents called me up. And as a drummer, a lot of drummers live for the here and now. They're like your dog. It's like, okay.
Today is good.
Right? Yeah. Don't ask me what I'm doing next week or next right. month or 5 years from now. So anyways, these parents started calling me up and they said, well, what do you got going for the summer? And I said, I don't know. So after four or five of them called me up, I thought, hey, this is opportunity knocking here. Maybe I should put something together.
Yeah, there's a need here.
Yeah.
Maybe I can fill it.
And I knew the classrooms from teaching at UIA were open on Friday afternoons. So I thought, well, I'll just offer a class once a week during the summer of 95. Immediately I had 25 kids sign up.
Wow. And it's been going strong since then, my gosh.
Yeah, so I had to hire a couple extra teachers. And my mission is to hook up professional musicians on a year-round basis from Anchorage, locally here, who spend a lot of time teaching on, learning on the bandstand like me. And some of them have, like, classroom experience, too. Mm-hmm. But these guys are pros. They're like the alpha wolf. And so, anyways, we started doing that, and then it just kept rolling.
Right. We're gonna take a tiny break and then come back. You've been listening to John Danberg, who is the founder of the Alaska Jazz Workshop, and we're going to hear some music during the hour, but we're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today, we're talking about jazz. We are talking with John Danberg, who founded the Alaska Jazz Workshop here in Alaska in 1995.
Right.
And he's really just been, this first segment was just kind of laying out how he began to work with kids in the school district, and then later in his own endeavor, the Alaska Jazz Workshop, sort of taking kids past just the performance to the listening and the tweaking and hearing all the possibilities that are in music that is part of maybe playing jazz. So we're going to introduce the other folks here, but John, you were just going to finish up that little description of the Alaska Jazz Workshop, and then we'll introduce the other guests and maybe we'll hear a little music.
Sure. So anyways, in 95 I started it, and then for 5 years I just did it, and it just kids just kept coming, you know, middle school, high school kids. And because I had all the connections with the teachers in the schools, I would put out a little information to them and say, hey, you know, if you want to have your kids grow more musically than you're able to in a regular classroom setting, send over your kids and we'll work with them and they'll become the cornerstones of your music department, especially, and they all want to have good jazz bands,
mm-hmm.
And concert bands and orchestras and that kind of stuff, too. So anyways, we did it for 5 years. We had a regular, you know, a fall semester, spring semester. We did once a week classes during the summer. And then in 2000, one of our parents, Joyce Bamberger, who was a writer and a lawyer.
I know
in town.
Joyce.
You
yeah.
know Joyce?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Their son, Max Hensley, was a piano player in our program.
Mm-hmm.
She says she was willing to donate her services to incorporate us as a nonprofit. She says, you know, it could be good and it can be bad because, you know, it will have a lot more paperwork that you'll have to fill out every year, but the advantage of it is that you can write grants.
And you're a nonprofit then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we became a nonprofit in 2000. And in 2000, we also started doing our summer camp, like a week-long intensive, where I invited a guest artist from outside. And we've had lots of guest artists, really good ones, along with our in-town teachers. So usually I have a guest artist and then three other bands that have in-town teachers. We run a beginning, intermediate, advanced classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that went for years and years and years. We've had people from like Bobby Shue, who's a great jazz trumpet player, used to play with Buddy Rich's band. We've had Dennis de Blasio up here three times, a great jazz educator, play with Maynard Ferguson's band, and is the head of the jazz department at Rowan School for the Arts just outside of Philadelphia. We've had Jovino Santos.
You've got the contacts, clearly, right?
Well, everybody wants to come up here.
Yeah, in the summer. That's classic,
right?
Too.
So if you can pay them a reasonable wage and provide them with a situation that's fun, they love coming up. So
yeah.
I'm a lover of Latin jazz. So I have a lot of guys who are involved in that. I've had Oscar Stagnaro, the bass player for Paquito de Rivera's band up here.
Mm-hmm.
We just had Amina Figueroa, who's a great jazz pianist and composer, and her husband, Bart Plateau, a jazz flautist out of New York City. She's originally from Azerbaijan, and he is from the Netherlands. And she's got like 14 albums to her, you know, credit. Anyways, so I was mainly working with the middle school, high school kids. And then in 2006, we started taking them on jazz field trips down to the Next Generation Jazz Festival.
Is it New Orleans?
That's in Monterey.
Oh, Monterey, okay.
And then the last couple of years, just last year, we took them down to New Orleans for a six-day trip, and we played six concerts and did two jazz festivals. The year before, we went to Havana, Cuba. And all of these folks that you're going to meet in a minute have been on these field trips, and they can maybe talk about if it's changed their life or approach
great.
To music.
Well, let's introduce some of them. I'm going to work my way around from Norberto de Jesus Jr.
Yes.
You are a UAA student.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska. First time you've been on the radio here?
Yes.
Okay. And you are a bass player?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. It's sitting there in your lap, so it was a clue for me. And then we also have Monica Jenisek. And Monica, you have a legal background, right?
Yes, I do. I was a lawyer for 40 years.
And what do you play?
I play the keyboards.
Okay, so keyboards. So we've got a bass keyboard. And then we have Clay Johnson, who's 16 in high school. And you're sitting in front of the keyboard, so that's a clue.
I do play the piano.
Okay. And, you know, since we listened a lot to John, I would like to go back and we could do one of two things. We could play a little music right now. I'm getting nods of approval. You like that? And then I'll come back and talk to you individually. What would you like to play?
It's open. I think we should just play a blues and maybe demonstrate a little bit about the basic form that leads to improvisation. The blues was a combination of the African rhythms, their rhythmic sensibility of swing, or with the African sense of that everybody can sing. So a lot of your blues singers don't have real smooth, polished voices. They have more of a, I don't want to say a guttural, but, you know, earthy. Let's call it earthy. Like African instruments have an earthy sound compared to the European instruments. They aren't just real pretty bell-like.
Mm-hmm.
They have this, they're a little bit raw around the edges, which gives them that sensibility. And they met up with the European instruments, like the cornet, clarinet, piano, tuba, before the string bass, and the European sense of harmony, which gives the blues its song form, which is 12 measures. So the blues is like the African newspaper. It has 3-4 measure phrases. The first one is a call, like I'd be calling you to maybe invite you to have lunch. I'd say, hey, can you have lunch? And you're over in your field tending your flock of sheep. And you listen, what's John saying? Right, so that would be the first sentence. And then now I got your attention, we would say it again. Hey, do you want to come over and have lunch? Right, and the third phrase would be the answer, or the punchline. So that would be your answer.
Uh-huh.
And Monica's
so it's call and response in a way.
Call
yeah.
and response. So
and that's endemic to the blues.
Yeah, and okay. jazz grew out of the blues.
Okay.
So your original blues was either done as work songs, or field howlers by the slaves, or your early blues musicians like Leadbelly, just a guitar player,
mm-hmm.
and they would run the circuit along the Mississippi Delta
mm-hmm.
And play just very simple chords. Usually the blues is based on the one chord and the four chord and the five chord of the key you're in.
Oh, okay.
And the interesting thing about it is it plays off the mixture of the blues scale. Monica, you want to demonstrate the blues scale? Which is a different flavor than the major scale.
Sure. It's off a little. It to me, it sounds not like it's not in tune, but it's just a touch off.
Yeah. So instead of like a major scale has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know, the blues has 1, flat 3, 4, sharp 4, 5, flat 7, and 8.
Okay.
Okay. So that comes from Africa and Asia, too. Asia uses these five-note scales, these pentatonic scales.
Uh-huh.
There's also the minor pentatonic scale, which is 1, flat 3, 4, 5, flat 7, and 8. Then there's also the major pentatonic scale, which is 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, and 8.
You're losing me, so I want to say let's go to the music.
Okay, so let's play some.
Okay.
So a lot of your folk music, like Stephen Foster music, is based off that major pentatonic.
Okay.
Like Camptown Races.
Yes.
You know, way down upon a Suwannee River.
Right.
It's got that vibe to it.
So they're going to play a simple blues. Does it have a name? And is everybody going to play? You're going to play, Norberto?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? Are you singing? Clay?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Clay's going to direct.
I'm going to listen.
We just had a swap out on the keyboard. So Monica is sitting on the keyboards. And
yeah, and one of the nice things about this kind of music is most of this blues and then jazz later has sort of a Cliff Notes shorthand idea what the tune is. But the difference between this and, say, classical music is everybody can put their own spin on the melody. So, like, if you're going to do Happy Birthday, I could do it my way, Norberto could do it his way, Monica could do it her way, and Clay could do it his way. And we go, that's cool.
And you each take your turn doing that.
Yeah,
You don't try to do that all at once. You just take your turn and you give your version. And that would be jazz, some example of what happens with jazz.
Sure. The other thing, too, about this is it's very much about communication while we're doing it. And it's very much before you play the tune on the bandstand, it's like ad hoc. So I'd say to Monica, what tune do you want to play today?
And I'll say, let's just do a B flat blues.
Okay. And Norberto says, yeah, okay, I know the blues in B flat.
Go ahead, Norberto. Let's hear you say that.
Oh, yes, I know the blues.
Okay.
And then actually,
that's Clay.
Going off what you guys said earlier, I've actually heard, I'm not at this level yet, but I've heard some professional musicians. And I heard them talk before a gig, and the level of planning that they had on this gig was just, like, filthy low.
Filthy low, okay.
Yeah, it's absurd. They said something like this. Hey, I think we'll do a few of Greta's tunes. Greta was the singer. I think we'll do a few of Greta's tunes, maybe a few bop tunes. Yeah. That was basically, and then they played a two-hour gig after that.
So you really need to pay attention, and you need to know what those clues are.
Yeah.
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 Well, and there's a common language, too, which is what we call standards in this world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whether it's a Broadway show tune, or it's a blues standard, or a bebop, like a bebop is an era within the jazz that came after the big band era in the late 1940s and the 50s. There's all these different developmental eras in jazz.
Yeah.
But let's play a song for you.
Okay.
So, being that I'm the drummer, I'm playing a djembe. This is an African hand drum that I got from my cohort, Jill Crosby, over at UAA, and this comes from Ghana. So, anyways, we'll play a couple choruses, a couple 12-bar choruses, and we'll go back and forth. Monica will take a solo, Norberto will take a solo, and then we'll do some trading back and forth between them and me.
Okay.
Which we call trading fours.
Okay. Okay.
One, two, one, two, three, four. Thank you.
if you are just tuning into Hometown Alaska and you're wondering, well, what was going on there? We are having a show on the Jazz Workshop, and we just had a blues number by some of the students from the Jazz Workshop and John Danberg. I got to do a shout out to Monica Genesek on the keyboards, Roberto De Jesus on the bass, and of course on the
djembe.
Djembe was John Danberg, and sort of swinging the shoulders and listening to the whole thing and rocking out in the corner here was Clay Johnson, who is a keyboardist, and we'll probably get a chance to hear you at another point maybe. So that was really fun, and you did demonstrate how you went. Everybody played, and then we went to Monica, and you sort of had a variation, and then we went back to Roberto, and you had a variation, and then you did. And then there may have been things I missed in between, John.
Oh, yeah. Well, think of this. Think of this kind of music. Improvisatory music is like having a cell phone conversation between four people, or five people, or three, mm-hmm. whatever, however big your group is. So everybody has a common language. Say we're speaking English, or maybe in France we speak mm-hmm. French or whatever. So we understand what words mean. So here we have a common language of a song form, a 12-bar song form. Monica and Norberto know the chords. They know the progression because there's a certain like set place where the one and the four and the five chords go. And if you know that, you can go all the way around the world and play with all sorts of people.
Whether or not you speak their language, their oral language, yeah. If you know the music language, you can.
Yeah, music is truly the universal language. Yeah. And it's a heads-up ball game. It's sort of like playing soccer and dribbling the ball down the field. Whoever's got the solo is got the soccer ball. And everybody else should be watching that person to complement what they're doing. And if they pass off to them, they'll receive the ball, right? So when we're playing trading fours, Monica starts, she passes it off to me, I pass it back, then we pass it over to Norberto, and it's like that. And the other thing is this kind of music is a call and response not only between the musicians, but between the musicians and the audience. Because this kind of music was originally played for an audience a lot of times for dancing, mm-hmm. right? So it wasn't really ever meant in the original days to be a concert. Mm-hmm. It was like let's go down to the club on Friday night, you know.
It's a community thing. Everybody's engaged.
Let's dance.
Now I want to ask you a question. It seems like a lot of responsibility. I mean, if you're going to throw it to Roberto or you're going to throw it to Monica, what if you flub it? What do the musicians just come together and cover that up, or what happens?
Okay, you guys talk.
Roberto or Clay?
I've heard something interesting on this. So there's a video by Herbie Hancock, and he's talking about a time when he played with Miles Davis, iconic trumpet player.
Yes.
And Herbie says that he played a note that he thought was totally wrong, and then Miles played some notes and made his chord right. So going to something more recent, actually there's a British musician named Jacob Collier who's just a genius.
Oh yeah.
And there's a video on YouTube. And basically, he explains how every single note, any note, works with any chord. That doesn't necessarily mean it's pleasing to the ear.
So there can be flubs, but there's ways of addressing those flubs.
Well, see, the thing is that if everybody's listening to each other, there was an NPR radio show done on this, I think it was last year, on a national basis, mm-hmm. and they were interviewing Stefan Harris's group, they were talking about what not just music improvisation, but improvisation in sports and improvisation in music and all that. And it came down to that if everybody is a pretty well-trained player, that there's no wrong notes. There's just more tense and more resolved notes. And so if Stefan took a left turn in the middle of a song, if everybody was listening to him, they take a left turn too.
Okay.
So then it would sound like, oh, that's okay. Yeah. Or if Monica took a right turn where she normally would take a left turn, we would be flexible and say, oh, well, let's go with Monica because she's running the ball over to the right side of the field.
Mm. I see.
And we wouldn't all run over to the left side of the field, would you?
No.
It'd be sort of like a Monty Python kind of thing. So the part of the deal with the Jazz Workshop is to give students a vocabulary, because most of them don't listen to this kind of music. The older folks do, because mm-hmm. they grew up with that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. But the young kids don't. They're in jazz band because they think that's fun.
Yeah.
You know, their buddies are in, their girlfriend or boyfriend are in there. It's like, cool.
We've got to take a little break. I just wanted to remind folks that we're not taking phone calls today. This is a pre-recorded show. But if you do have questions, send them on in to hometownatalaskapublic.org, and we'll work our way back to them if you do have questions or comments. We'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're here with the Alaska Jazz Workshop today, a community asset in Anchorage that's been around teaching adults and kids of all ages, really, middle school to high school, how to be jazz musicians, how to listen to each other, how to... We were just talking about how to... If we have a fumble, it's not really a fumble. A fumbled note, it's actually a different direction in the tune, and so jazz musicians would know how to deal with that and take that route. In the studio, we've got John Danberg, the founder of Alaska Jazz Workshop. We've got Clay Johnson. Say hi again, Clay.
Hey, guys.
He's 16. He's homeschooled, and he's quite a musician. He's going to be on the keyboards for the next tune. We've got Norberto de Jesus, who is a UAA student, a composer, and a videographer. He's on the bass here today, and you heard him just a few minutes ago. And, of course, Monica Janicek, a pianist. She was just on the blues tune that we just played. And I think what I want to do is spend a little time talking to the students about being the recipient of all this education. But I'm wondering, should we play a tune first and then go back to that? All right. So does someone want to introduce what you're going to do next? Clay.
So we're going to do a little bit of a funky tune. We're going to play B-flat sort of blues called Chameleon by Herbie Hancock. The only thing is because I'm not cool and I don't know the melody to this tune, so I'm just going to play something different.
So you're throwing a wrench into the whole thing right away.
So
you're signaling to your fellow artists that they're going to be ready for that?
I mean, I'm not going to play something that's going to be outside of the changes, but which is the chords to that song, but I'm not going to play the melody because I don't know it.
Oh, interesting.
I probably should, but I don't.
John, any comment on that?
Yeah, that's fine. Usually it's just like a drum thing. Uh-huh. Drummers get together and they'll play a groove. Like, I'll start this out, and then Norberto will join me, and then Clay will play on top of that. We'll do it like a layer thing.
Okay.
So, again, the drummer is the most important for setting out the musical rhythmic foundation, of which then the bass player starts building the roots of the harmonic progression, the chords, and then any of your melody players, like the piano can be melody and chords both, or guitar can be both, but you know, any of your horns, saxes, flutes, trombones, violins, things like that can do that. So we'll do this. Let's jam.
And it's called Chameleon, did you say?
Yes, Chameleon by Herbie Hancock. If you want to hear the full version, yeah, check it out.
All right. Thank you. Refreshing. That was Chameleon, and we went back and forth. You started it, John. We jumped over to Clay on the piano and then to Norberto on the bass. Any messages out of that? How did it go?
Yeah, I need to listen better, because John was playing something, and I miss what he did. But that's kind of like the communication we were talking about earlier. Like, it's kind of a thing that, and I think this is part of what's cool about jazz, like, it forces you to be in the moment. Like, if I'm thinking about what my mom's cooking for dinner, like, that's...
dead in the water.
Yeah.
You're not
yep.
here and now. Right.
So.
Well, I think it's a real privilege to have you on, to have these students on. And so I just want to... We have, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so, a little longer. And I want to focus on you a little bit. I'm going to start with Clay, because you're on my left right here. Mm-hmm. and you seem very enthusiastic. So how did music enter your life?
Yeah, I started piano when I was 7. My mom got me into that. And then I wasn't super into it. I did the typical piano student stuff of, like, not wanting to practice and then, like, not getting better and all that stuff.
Irritating your parents.
Yeah. So, and then I had a magical moment one day, and I was playing the piano not very well. And then I actually accidentally played the blues. And these are the notes I played. I remember, like, super distinctly. And I played those by accident, the first four notes of an F minor blues scale. And I just remember I, like, couldn't get over at 9 years old, like, how cool that was.
that was the beginning, the true beginning.
Yeah, and so that, like, just blew my mind because I was like, oh, wow, that sounds really good. And I just went to keep playing that. And then, yeah, when I was 12, I got into, I joined John's group for jazz. And that was really cool. I didn't really know exactly what I was listening to at that time. I was pretty young. But we went down to Monterey, and that was a pretty cool experience.
Jazz festival, I'm assuming?
So John took us all down to the Monterey Next Generation Jazz Festival.
Next Generation, okay.
Which is like a big event, and it's like the younger student version of that.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So that we'll come back to you, Clay. Monica, let's come to you. Now, you represent the adult in the room here, besides John, of course. Tell me how music came into your life.
I played classical piano as a kid, and then I dropped it like a handkerchief when I started working. But I always knew I wanted to learn to improvise jazz, but I couldn't. I just didn't have the time when I was working as a lawyer. And so when I retired, I called John and I said, I want to learn to do this, and you are starting with somebody who knows nothing.
Really? And you can know nothing and start down
nothing.
This road.
You okay. can know nothing wow. and start down the road. And that was, for me, that was 6 years ago. And then 5 years ago, I had enough of a background, which isn't saying much, that there, John had some other students, a guitar player, a bass player, me and a drummer, and we started playing together 5 years ago, and then there have been other iterations where we've had a percussion player and horn players come in and out. But so the core group, though, has been together for 5 years, and I will say that I've learned more about humility in this endeavor than I ever did practicing
lessons,
law.
I know when I was having conversations with John before the show, he talked a lot about the life lessons that can come out of music. And I guess you're just giving us one right
there. Totally. Yeah. But it's just been, it's been such a great experience. And all of us in this group of Monday night group of John's, I mean, we are totally into it. I practice 3 hours a day, almost every day. So I feel like I'm like, you know, 5,000 hours into my 10,000 hour apprenticeship. And boy, I need those next 5,000 hours to get.
That's great. And people often don't have 3 hours when they're in their professional lives. But now, having finished with that, you're able to do that kind of intensity.
So, correct.
Norberto, let's bring you on. You're a UAA student, and I noticed a composer and a videographer. But how did music enter your life?
Let's see. Well, I guess growing up in a Puerto Rican household, there was always...
There's music everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time.
Yeah. All right, were you born in Alaska, or did you move here? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Born and raised.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there was always Latin music and like Afro-Caribbean rhythms. And and so like I was able to play the clave at a really young age. And
what's
usually,
the clave? Excuse
it's,
me.
It's kind of like the rhythmic heartbeat of Latin music.
Okay.
And so there's variations of it, but...
You should have John play it on the drums so they can hear it.
Okay.
Yeah, this is in
this
the
is
United,
called the clave.
Yeah, this is a 3-2 son, S-O-N, clave, and it provides the foundation for a lot of music we hear in Puerto Rico and Cuba. Originally comes from Africa. And in America, if you know the song The Hand Jive or the Bo Diddley, that's the 3-2 clave.
Okay.
So it's this. And then it's fleshed out. So, I tell you what, can we play, Clay? Can we
just
play?
Clue you in. We have probably 5 minutes, but okay. but we'll want to come back and talk.
Well, let's demonstrate.
Just
this is sort
demo.
Of like the New Orleans groove of just saying F blues, okay? Yeah. So you're going to go dum 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 bing boom dum 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 1 2 3 4. That's the 3-2 clave.
Okay.
Good. Okay, cool.
So Norberto, when you say from way back when I could play the clave, you just knew that you knew the rhythm. Were you playing it on an instrument or on a drum or just clapping?
Yeah, just clapping or there's little clave sticks, little auxiliary percussion.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's kind of where I started playing drums around, I think, like third grade, maybe, and it was just kind of messing around with it, never took it really serious. Hopped on bass around sixth grade or seven, then got involved with the Alaska Jazz Workshop.
How old were you when you started there?
Alaska Jazz Workshop?
Uh-huh.
Seventh grade, so is that?
Yeah, you're seventh grade.
Seventh grade, okay.
Yeah, his dad, I can credit his dad for being really wanting to pass the torch. His dad loves music. Norberto de Jesus Sr.
Senior. Uh-huh.
And, you know, no matter wherever I saw him, he was always playing music for Norberto Jr.
Yeah.
And he thought it was really important for Norberto to be playing with other people, sharing his love for music with other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how did you, is the bass your main instrument now, or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how did that develop? Through the jazz workshop, or you just picked it out yourself, or?
Yeah, I'd say through the jazz workshop.
Mm-hmm.
I began... Yes, it was drums, then alto sax in like sixth grade for band. So I enjoyed the rhythmic element. I enjoyed the melodic element. And I found sort of a crossroad with the bass.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that began to develop. And then with these scales that I've never heard of, like Mixolydian scale, Phrygian, I've only known, you know, major and minor. And then when I was exposed to this whole new world of scales and melodies.
Modes,
and yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I got serious with it.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. Before we took a break, I was sort of saying, well, what about intimidation? And everybody kind of laughed and said, oh, yeah, that's a good question. So, Clay, speak to intimidation. When did it arrive, or is it a constant with you as you're playing, or what?
Yeah, actually, I would say that for me, a problem was actually not necessarily intimidation. but actually lack thereof, or ego.
So sure you could do it no
matter
what.
Yeah, like thinking that I was like, man, I'm a guy, I can play jazz piano. And like, oh, actually I couldn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was...
different twist on the intimidation question.
Yeah, I just always got to check myself and like think like, what do I sound like? What do I look like? Am I even playing jazz, you know?
Yeah. So. And Monica, you know, adults learning new things, when they've mastered like a career, it can be very hard to be at the beginning. So you spoke about humility, but I just wonder, how did you get over the intimidation of, boy, I'm going to sound lousy when I start out?
You never get over the intimidation.
Oh, okay.
If you come to this as an adult, you will be intimidated.
Yeah.
But you just pick up the pieces and go on, and if the performance isn't what you hoped it would be, which generally it's not, you just say, okay, next time I'm going to be better, and next time I'm going to be better, and you record yourself, because sometimes when you go back and listen to how you performed 3 years ago, you see that even though you can't hear it on a day-to-day basis, you are getting better.
Mm. So it's worth it to have some early recordings so you can go back and listen.
Absolutely.
To them. John, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I think one of the coolest things about this is when you are intimidated, hopefully you're working in a group that is mutually supportive, right? And that's one of the things that I try to do with the jazz workshop, besides giving the students vocabulary of, you know, songs to learn and licks that to play, you know, standard stuff that's played in the form, is I try to get them to balance out the community aspect, in that if somebody's trying to create a melodic line, you support them, and because you know they're feeling uncomfortable when they first start
it's
out.
It's visible.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, you just made a mistake. It's not like that. It's like we're all human beings.
Yeah.
This is music that's in the moment. We're playing a game of soccer, and it goes down along the way.
Relax, it's everybody.
Like,
yeah.
Just kick back and enjoy the ride.
Okay.
Right? Herbie Hancock had a big thing. They were talking on again on NPR about who owns a performance. Like sometime he'll come off from playing, and he didn't think he did very well, and then the sound engineer goes, wow, man, that's the best I've ever heard you play.
Yeah, there you go.
So it's like, who owns the performance?
Right.
So that's why when Monica said record yourself, it's like a lot of times when you get farther away from the initial performance, you go, that wasn't so bad.
Well, we can't get to Norberto and intimidation. You hear the music, we are out of time. So I want to thank John Danberg, Clay Johnson, Norberto De Jesus, and Monica Genesek, and of course our listeners. I'll be back as your host next Monday with Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, when co-host Senior Judge Elaine Andrews and I explain how Alaska's judicial retention system works just before our November election. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.